the vast majority of Americans don't know what Muscle Shoals is.
If you, dear listener, are among that vast majority of Americans, let me clear things up for you. Along the Tennessee-Alabama border, the Tennessee River flows out of Tennessee and into North Alabama a couple of times along its meandering route. Four small cities, known collectively as the Quad Cities, sit along that river in North Alabama. They are Muscle Shoals, Florence, Sheffield, and Tuscumbia. Combined population, 80,000, give or take a few hundred. You can start in Florence, the only quad city on the north bank of the Tennessee, then drive over the O'Neill Bridge down to Muscle Shoals, west to Sheffield, then north to Tuscumbia, and be back in Florence in less than an hour. Easy. Now, folks who live there call the entire area the Shoals. And the Shoals area, particularly the city of Muscle Shoals, is known for its sound. I suppose Rob Bowman, whose voice you just heard, is right when he says the vast majority of Americans haven't heard of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. But there is a certain group of Americans and Europeans and Asians and Africans, for that matter, who do know what Muscle Shoals, Alabama represents.
You know, music nerds know, of course.
Rob Bowman is the author of a new book, the product of 6 years of reporting and research about Muscle Shoals and its sound.
Muscle Shoals is too little known to a lot of people. I'm doing a book of Muscle Shoals. They're not music people. I have to explain. They have no idea what it might be. So I think in general, it's not understood how important this one small space was to the three, we'll call them the three major realms of American music, R&B, country, and pop/rock. And unless, again, you're a deep music nerd, you probably don't know that.
You might know the Motown sound out of Detroit. And you might know the Stax Records sound out of Memphis, Tennessee. So what is this Muscle Shoals sound? Well, it's this. The Muscle Shoals sound is also this. And this. And this. And this. That's right. Percy Sledge and Wilson Pickett and dozens of other groundbreaking soul artists recorded hits in North Alabama. And so did Paul Simon and Tim McGraw and Bob Seger and even the Rolling Stones. The book I have always hoped someone would write about Muscle Shoals comes out this month. It's by the Grammy Award-winning music historian and author Rob Bowman. The book is called Land of a Thousand Sessions, The Complete Muscle Shoals Story, 1951 to 1985. It is deeply researched, filled with rare photographs, and I guarantee you, it'll make you listen to a whole bunch of records you've heard before without knowing where they came from, and turn you on to some wonderful tunes you might never have heard at all, although you should have. Today, we're going to let Rob tell us just how important a little patch of land in North Alabama has been to the world of music. And we're going to get some help from an old friend of mine whose name you might know, who grew up right there in the Quad Cities. I'm Chuck Reese, and welcome to Salvation South Deluxe, a monthly series of audio magazine pieces that we add to our regular podcast feed. On Deluxe, we aim to tell you stuff about the Southern experience that you never knew, or at least didn't know enough about. We do that by letting you hear the voices of people who make this region truly unique. Music recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama is so ubiquitous in American culture that many artists who recorded there are recognized by one name only: Aretha, Etta, Mavis, Simon, Seeger, The Stones. But none of these legends would have gone looking for that Muscle Shoals sound had it not been for a fella named Rick Hall.
Well, the main ingredients was Rick Hall.
Hall was born in 1932, about 45 miles west of Muscle Shoals in Forest Grove, Mississippi. His mother left his family when Rick was just 4 years old, and his father worked in sawmills in northeastern Mississippi and northwest Alabama. They lived in sawmill shacks until Rick was 10, when his father was able to move them into a permanent home, a log cabin. Now, the Halls had precious little money, but a lot of music. His father played country songs at home, and he sang in a gospel quartet. In high school, Rick played fiddle in a Future Farmers of America string band. But after two tragedies that happened in 2 weeks of each other in 1957, the death of Rick's young wife in a car crash, and then his father in a tractor accident, Rick wound up in Florence, Alabama, recording demos with another aspiring musician, James Joyner, whose family owned the local Trailways bus station. After the final passengers cleared out at night, Joyner would turn the bus station into a makeshift recording studio, and in that bus station, Rick Hall channeled his grief into a hell-bent pursuit of success in the music industry.
Rick was the kind of person who had a determination, a willpower, a refusal to accept reality, or the word no, and decided he was just going to do it, goddammit, by himself, with no money, terrible equipment.
Hall founded a music publishing company called FAME, an acronym for Florence, Alabama Music Enterprises. He had three partners in this enterprise: Joyner, a local beatnik named Tom Stafford, whose dad owned a local drugstore, and Hall's high school friend, Billy Sherrill, who would go on to become a legendary producer of country music in Nashville. The four FAME partners put a recording studio upstairs from that drugstore, but only one record was made there before Rick Hall and his partners had a falling out. So Hall rented space in an abandoned Muscle Shoals building. It had once housed the Tri-Cities Candy and Tobacco Company. And in that building, in 1961, Hall produced a song for a 21-year-old black songwriter and soul singer named Arthur Alexander. The song was called You Better Move On.
You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me.
The record peaked at number 24 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in early 1962. And in 1963, a new band from Britain re-recorded You Better Move On for their very first record. They were called the Rolling Stones.
Yes, and the Lord above, you better move on.
That marked the beginning of Rick Hall's unlikely story, a story that probably wouldn't have happened without the programming of a Muscle Shoals radio station, WLAY.
Every small town had local radio, but WLAY, for whatever reason, long after everybody else switched to Top 40, was playing a huge range of music. So you'd hear country, you'd hear R&B, you'd hear pop, you'd hear rock. And so, for whatever it's worth, a lot of these guys growing up locally were hearing things from a wide range of musics and pulling on all of them into who they became as musicians. You have white guys fascinated with black R&B. And they learned to play it the best they can, maybe not perfectly, but some of them got really, really, really good.
Throughout the rest of the early 60s, an increasing number of singers came to Muscle Shoals for the chance to record with those really, really, really good musicians. not household names maybe, but great soul singers such as Joe Tex and Jimmy Hughes, whose records, in my view at least, should be in every collection. But in the first month of 1966, the future of Muscle Shoals was forever changed by a young singer from Layton, Alabama, named Percy Sledge. To understand all the twists and turns that led to Sledge cutting his immortal song, When a Man Loves a Woman, in Muscle Shoals, you will need to buy your own copy of Rob Bowman's book. Sledge recorded the song in February. Rick Hall knew it was destined to be a bigger hit than anything thus far recorded in Muscle Shoals, so he reached out to Jerry Wexler, the head of one of the largest record labels in the world, Atlantic, to see if he could strike a deal to distribute the record. Wexler made that deal, and by early April of 1966, When a Man Loves a Woman was number one on Billboard's R&B charts and its pop chart, and it stayed on both of those charts for months.
And eventually, the early Muscle Shoals secret is Black artists, great artists, from Arthur Alexander to Etta James to Aretha Franklin, playing with these white rhythm section that had learned to be adaptable and play whatever, including really deep-seated R&B.
Percy Sledge's global hit made musicians everywhere wonder how a little Alabama town had developed its secret symphonic sauce. But it wasn't until the following year, when Aretha Franklin came to Fame Studios in 1967, that Muscle Shoals had its most magical moment. The name Aretha is known to everyone, with hit after hit after hit, like Respect and Think, Chain of Fools. She became the Queen of Soul. But to put her visit to Muscle Shoals in context, you need a little background. Franklin was born in the South, in Memphis, in 1942, but when she was only 2 years old, her family followed the Great Migration north. By 1965, the Franklins had settled in Detroit. In that city, her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, became the pastor of New Bethel Baptist Church and one of the most famous black ministers in America. During the Civil Rights Movement, Reverend Franklin worked closely with Martin Luther King Jr. Franklin helped to stage King's famous Freedom March down Detroit's Woodward Avenue in the summer of 1963. And Aretha had grown up singing powerful renditions of gospel songs and playing piano at New Bethel. When she was 18, she told her father that she wanted to pursue a career in pop music, as other black gospel performers, such as Sam Cooke, had done. The Reverend became her manager, and he helped her sign a contract with Columbia Records. So from 1961 to 1966, Aretha released 8 albums on Columbia, but none of them produced a single that cracked the top 30 on the Billboard Singles Chart. How could that have happened? I'm going to quote from Rob's book here because he can explain it better than I ever could. He writes, they had her recording a melange of standards, jazz, pop, blues, and R&B. Often draped in lush orchestrations, her gospel impulses were kept to a minimum. As time went on, Aretha's overall sales with Columbia continued to diminish. And by 1965, it was clear to many in the industry that Aretha Franklin was unhappy and was looking for a new deal once her Columbia contract expired in 1966. So, enter the aforementioned Jerry Wexler, the head of Atlantic Records, who offered Franklin a contract with his label. And his first move was to send her to Muscle Shoals, where at Fame Studios on January 24th, 1967, she recorded her first big hit, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You. When Aretha Franklin died in 2018, I interviewed Spooner Oldham, whose hands on the Wurlitzer electric piano are the first notes you hear on that song. This is what Oldham told me. Coming to Muscle Shoals probably resonated with the Southern experience in her brain, even though she'd been gone forever. And then, when she was allowed to turn loose with all that Southern expression, we just played our hearts out because we were used to that stuff. I mean, we weren't used to her because she was top of the heap, but she brought it all out of us.
That one session where Spooner comes up with the riff, ba 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 da,
you're no good.
It's a brilliant riff, but then Aretha comes hammering in on the gospel piano. That studio changed. They were floored. Everyone I spoke to, jaw-dropping to hear what Aretha could do. This was a magic moment. This is a transformative moment in the history of American music. Starts off a run of some of the greatest soul records in history, some of the greatest records in history.
Salvation South Deluxe will be right back with what happened after that magic moment after a short break. Spooner Oldham was just one of many local musicians who played in Rick Hall's house bands at Fame Studios through the 60s. But as that decade neared an end, the focus narrowed down to a core of four musicians: drummer Roger Hawkins, guitarist Jimmy Johnson, bass player David Hood, and the keyboardist Barry Beckett. Rob Bowman walked me through the unique talents of each.
Roger Hawkins, one of the greatest drummers in American music history, one of the top three or four, had a lighter sound than, let's say, Al Jackson at Stax. Al Jackson played slightly behind the beat, but a real heavy, big sticks. Roger, not as far behind the beat, and with a slightly lighter sound, even though when he needed to, he could do great tom-tom fills and stuff.
David Hood.
David Hood's bass lines, they're very unique. Listen to what he plays in, Respect Yourself.
That's a hit by the Staple Singers.
Just a line that's so definitive of that song. But when I started working on this, I literally listened to, I'd say, 99.9% of every recording ever made there. And I'd be listening analytically. There's so many times I point out, a David Hood bass line, that's so distinctive.
Jimmy Johnson.
Jimmy Johnson, once he became a session musician, he stopped playing lead. He would play these rhythmic, what he called chinks and chunks. Often with the strings muted, there are these just rhythmic figures, and they're often so subtle, your average listener is not going to hear it unless they really focus. You can hear a record 100 times, and suddenly go, oh my God, listen to that. It's there.
And Barry Beckett.
It's too late. She's gone.
Beckett, he was a country player. When he first came to work at Fame and Unmuscle Sound, for the first year, they didn't think he was going to make it. He was too white sounding. They kept saying, listen to Aretha. You got to be able to play like that. And he eventually got it. But he doesn't lose his country touch.
These four constituted the band that would go down in history as the Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section. But they did have a nickname, too. The Swampers.
Now Muscle Shoals has got the Swampers. And they've been known for song two.
When Lynyrd Skynyrd, in that ubiquitous 1974 song Sweet Home Alabama, gave a shout-out to the Swampers, they were referring to Roger Hawkins, Jimmy Johnson, David Hood, and Barry Beckett. As the 60s neared an end, though, the Swampers got unhappy with the compensation they were getting and the creative control they did not get working for Rick Hall at Fame. So they left and started their own studio called Muscle Shoals Sound. Back in the 1990s, I drove from Atlanta to Athens, Georgia one night to hear my cousin's band play in a little nightclub, long since closed, called The Hi-Hat. Greg Reese, my cousin, introduced me to the guy who was mixing sound in the club, a fellow who had just moved to Athens from Alabama. We chatted for a while before Greg's show began, and the sound guy told me he'd been in a band in Alabama for a long time, but it had just broken up. He decided to move to Athens into a completely different music scene to start over. Before we parted, I asked him his name. Patterson Hood, he said. I asked where in Alabama he was from. Muscle Shoals, he said. Are you kin to David Hood, like the bass player in the Swampers? That's my dad, Patterson replied. So when I got my copy of Rob Bowman's book, I noticed that it begins with an epigraph, a quote from my friend Patterson Hood, who, as you might know, has led for more than 30 years an important Southern rock band called the Drive-By Truckers. And that epigraph says this: I can't think of anything in the world cooler and more beautiful than the miracle that occurred in this most unlikely of places during my childhood. My hometown seemed to me a land that time forgot, in the buckle of the Bible Belt, in a somewhat backward-looking dry county in North Alabama, a community almost completely controlled politically and culturally by a couple of churches and isolated by geography and culture. But it had spawned a musical revolution that created worldwide shockwaves. And when I read that, I thought, where have I read that before? Then I realized it was from an article that I had asked Patterson to write for my publication about a dozen years ago. A long time ago, I asked Patterson how old he was when he wrote his first song. He told me he was only 8. But I never really talked to him much about his childhood, about growing up in the middle of all that musical magic.
I was an outcast, you know, because I was this, you know, arty, weird kid that wrote songs all the time and was obsessed with music and movies and didn't like sports.
Did the kids he was in school with realize what was happening right there in their hometown?
No one I went to school with had any idea that was going on. It was a secret.
It was a secret because of the racial climate of the Jim Crow era. The people who were making the Muscle Shoals sound were worried about what might happen if the whole Quad Cities population knew that black and white musicians were working together.
They were like a secret society, which they did on purpose because they were afraid if the locals knew what was going on, they would shut it down, you know, which was a danger. And so most people didn't really know about what was going on right under their noses.
A music nerd before he was 10, Patterson knew what was going on and wanted to hear more about it. But his father, David, proved reluctant to share his stories.
I would ask him questions about work, and he wouldn't answer me. He wouldn't tell me shit. And, you know, he was from that generation that didn't believe in talking about work at home. And also, I think he probably thought that I didn't need to know. And he didn't really want to encourage me to do music, you know. So that was kind of a weird thing because I wanted to hear about it. I was obsessed with it.
If David's intent was to dampen his son's obsession, his reluctance to share his stories was a complete failure. In 1971, the legendary Staple Singers recorded a hit in Muscle Shoals called I'll Take You There. About 2 minutes into the song, you hear the great Mavis Staples calling out David Hood.
All right, now, baby, little lady.
I vividly remember riding down the road with my grandmother driving and the radio on, and hearing "I'll Take You There" and knowing that was my dad and thinking that was the coolest thing in the world when Mavis started saying, "David, little David," I'm like, "That's my dad," you know.
It wasn't until the 1990s that little David finally opened up to his son about his musical experiences.
My granddaddy was dying, and we went down to Sarasota. We left the day after Christmas and drove to Sarasota, just the two of us. It's the only time we ever did a trip together like that. And we spent about a week driving down there and being there and saying bye to my granddaddy. And he told me stories about that for the first time in my life. He told me stories about Muscle Shoals and his experiences.
These stories detailed the intensity of Rick Hall's demands and showed the deep dedication that David Hood had when it came to meeting the standards required to make those hits.
You know, he was talking about the Rick Hall days, and, you know, Rick Hall would have, sometimes he'd show up and there'd be like eight bass players there all wanting the gig. And Rick would just go down the line in the pecking order. And if he didn't like what they were playing, he would send them home and bring in the next one. And Dad told me this story about playing a session and getting called out and sent home.
That was in 1967, not long before Etta James recorded her giant hit, "Tell Mama," in Muscle Shoals. And on that day, Swampers drummer Roger Hawkins gave David Hood an important talking to.
And Roger, who was a couple years younger than Dad, but was already kind of established as the badass, he was the drummer on all, everything. You know, he was the man ready. And he kind of called Dad aside and basically kind of chastised him. It's like, you know, if you're going to do this, you need to rise to the occasion. You need to, you know, if you get sent home again, you may not be here to get sent home after that and all that. And Dad said he went home and just stayed up all night playing till his fingers bled and just like was like so focused on being good enough. And sure enough, you know, next session might have been "Tell Mama." You know, who knows? It was something, one of the early ones, you know. And he delivered, and he got to be the guy. You know, he wasn't always the guy, but he was at least one of the main ones.
Not long after that road trip, Patterson Hood formed the Drive-By Truckers, and it wasn't long before you could hear how his father's experiences, his collaboration across the racial barriers to make music that the world still dances to today, had shaped his son's life and his son's view of the South. That's from DBT's third album, released in 2001, called Southern Rock Opera. Here's Rob Bowman again.
The Muscle Shoals sound, is it black culture? Is it white culture? It's part of both. All American music is a hybrid, but here you've got black and white working together and creating this incredible sound. The white guys have been obsessed with black music for a long time.
Similar things were happening in other places, in Detroit with Motown and in Memphis with Stax, but perhaps the Muscle Shoals sound developed as a distinct thing because the Quad Cities themselves had less of the racial tension or pressure that was found in those big cities.
Because when an artist came there to record, they had nothing to do but be in the studio. It was a dry county. There was no bars. Now, studios would have some beer downstairs that they would share, obviously. But it's not like you could go after a session, go out drinking, and the next day, oh, God, got to struggle to get in the studio. Basically, you're in the studio or you're in a hotel. And the Holiday Inn loved musicians so much because they were making so much money off musicians coming. They set up a suite with a piano and a tape recorder. So at night, musicians could be doing small demos, writing songs. And often, Muscle Shoals songwriters would rent that suite and be set up there for a week just to write songs. It was a perfect place to make music.
I like to think of Muscle Shoals as Wilson Pickett did when he arrived there in 1966. It was the land of a thousand dances. There are many people to thank for this episode. First off, I gotta thank Rob Bowman for even undertaking the writing of Land of a Thousand Sessions. It is a beautiful book, 12 inches by 12 inches, just like a record album, filled with rarely seen photographs and literally everything you could possibly want to know about the miracles that happened in the Quad Cities of North Alabama. Rob, I thank you for your time. We could have talked for hours, and I hope someday we will. I also want to thank Anna Danielski of Shorefire Media for all her work in getting these materials to us and scheduling our time with Rob. Thanks, as always, to Patterson Hood, my friend of 35 years now. Patterson's enthusiasm for Southern music and its history just seems to keep growing as he gets older. When I reached him in California for this interview, he was touring behind his brilliant solo album called Exploding Trees and Airplane Screams. You should give it a listen. And even though I did not interview David Hood or Spooner Oldham for this episode, I still want to thank them for chatting with me in the past. What an honor it has been to talk to these men who were part of one of the American South's greatest musical achievements. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every week, we add a new 3-minute commentary about Southern stuff to our podcast feed, and every month or so, we add longer deluxe stories such as the one we've just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, which you can find telling Southern stories 24/7 at salvationsouth.com. Our producer is Jake Cook, who also composed our theme music. Being a musician himself, Jake got really excited about this episode. We are probably going to have to take him to the Quad Cities for a tour of the Fame and Muscle Shoals Sound Studios. Both of them are still open for recording while also serving as museums where you can learn about and see this history for yourself. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell, and none of this could have happened without folks at GPB who place a high value on our Southern storytelling. Killer, Sandy Malcolm, Adam Woodleaf, and Burt Wesley. We will be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South Podcast.